Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about community development in the south side of Billings, the shuttering of an old shuttle service in Glacier National Park, and reactions to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. It's Thursday, December 12th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Senate has confirmed a top Justice Department lawyer with ties to Montana as a federal appeals court judge, despite a not qualified rating from the American Bar Association and sharp opposition from his home state senator. Lawrence Van Dyke, a deputy assistant attorney general, yesterday won a seat on the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers 9 western states. The vote was 51-44. Van Dyke previously served 4 years as Nevada's Solicitor General, after a similar term as Solicitor General in Montana and a failed campaign for Montana Supreme Court. Montana's 2 U.S. senators split their vote on Van Dyke's confirmation. Republican Senator Steve Daines voted to confirm, saying Van Dyke was a good man and beyond qualified, and the subject of attacks from far-left activists and the American Bar Association. Democrat John Tester urged his colleagues to reject the nomination. Tester said Van Dyke lacked any judicial experience, had poor work ethic, and noted opposition to the nomination from 6 former Montana Supreme Court justices. Montana Senators John Tester and Steve Daines jointly introduced legislation yesterday that would settle thousands of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes' water rights claims and also transfer management of the National Bison Range. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
Daines and the tribes announced they had come to an agreement last week that would end a decades-old battle over thousands of water rights claims that are bound for court. The agreement would relinquish most of those claims in exchange for $1.9 billion in federal funding for an irrigation project on the reservation. That's $400 million less than the tribes would have received under a 2015 compact approved by the state legislature and a similar bill Senator John Tester introduced in 2016. Both failed to get bipartisan support in Congress. In exchange for that concession, the new bill includes transferring management of the National Bison Range to the tribes. Tester has voiced support for the new deal and sponsored the bill along with Daines upon introduction Wednesday. Both senators say unlike the original compact proposal, the new bill does not need state lawmakers' approval. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
A Yellowstone County coalition received a $100,000 grant to implement their plans to spruce up the low-income south side of Billings. I found out more. The Healthy by Design Coalition is working to make the south side of Billings the bright side of the tracks, using sidewalk poetry and community cleanup events funded by the Kresge Foundation, a Detroit-based philanthropic private foundation that funds community development projects. Melissa Henderson is the Community Health Improvement Manager for the Healthy by Design Coalition, a partnership of over 50 organizations focused on improving public health.
Pride in Place effort is really around creating a new brand for the neighborhood, so that's where the Bright Side of the Tracks brand comes from. And then in addition to that, it's all about putting in public art so that the neighborhood feels more walkable, safer, just more enjoyable.
The grant money will go toward 2 efforts, Brighten Up events and the South Sidewalks Project. Brighten Up events will be opportunities for local businesses and residents to collaborate on neighborhood cleanup. The South Sidewalks Project combines art and utility by using sidewalks to connect community members.
The South Side has some of the oldest infrastructure in the city. It's one of the first neighborhoods, and there's been a lot of effort to replace sidewalk squares.
The coalition plans to take stock of sidewalks that need replacing while holding poetry workshops to collect poems from locals to stamp onto new squares. The South Sidewalks Project takes inspiration from sidewalk poetry in St. Paul, Minnesota. Colleen Sheehy is the executive director of Public Art St. Paul, a private nonprofit that worked with the city to develop the sidewalk poetry project. Sheehy says Billings is one of several cities to adopt sidewalk poetry and that public art can make people's lives more joyful and meaningful.
Public art helps people to feel connected to their places, and that's just really important today, to feel that the place you live is supportive.
The Healthy by Design Coalition will meet in the next few weeks to finalize their timeline for completing the South Sidewalks project. They're hoping to start stamping poems onto concrete this summer. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. A legal battle over whether temporary logging roads in grizzly bear habitat are effectively being closed may put a damper on logging projects in three national forests. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the case may be headed for an appeal.
A federal judge in Missoula this fall ordered the U.S. Forest Service to take a closer look at how temporary logging roads are still being used by motor vehicles. The Alliance for the Wild Rockies sued the federal government under the Endangered Species Act earlier this year, claiming traffic on those roads is harming grizzly bear habitat on the Kootenai National Forest. Executive Director Mike Garrity says the environmental group hired researchers to examine motorized use of roads closed via earthen berms on the Kootenai.
They found lots of cases where the road closures were not working, where people had driven over or around or through them. And so because of that, they were not in compliance with the forest plan.
Garrity's group also issued letters of intent to file similar lawsuits over 100 individual commercial and non-commercial projects on the Kootenai, Lolo, and Idaho Panhandle National Forests.
As a remedy, we wanted them to reconsult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on how they can reduce the biggest threat to grizzly bears, which was roads.
The federal court ordered the U.S. Forest Service to consult with federal wildlife managers in order to determine how successful its road closures are in grizzly bear habitat in both the Selkirk and Cabinet Yak recovery zones, both of which touch the Kootenai, Lolo, and Idaho Panhandle forests. Garrity says the Forest Service will need to find a way to effectively close roads.
Or if they can't, then they have to reduce the amount of roads they're building.
The Forest Service filed an appeal in the case last week, but that may just be a placeholder. In a series of letters last month, the Forest Service said it was complying with the court order by consulting with federal wildlife managers on 37 active commercial and non-commercial projects in the Kootenai and Idaho Panhandle National Forests. The Forest Service says no active projects in the Lolo would be impacted by the case. The assessment will determine how many roads in those forests may be violating road density rules. 15 of the projects in question are commercial timber sales, one of which has been halted. In an emailed statement, the Forest Service says it's still assessing whether action needs to be taken on the other sales.
I am perplexed by the decision. It doesn't bode well for the industry.
In an interview shortly before the Forest Service began its assessment in November, Julia Altimus with the Montana Wood Products Association said she not only feared that the ruling could stymie active timber sales, but also limit future projects that require road building.
Hopefully, we can find a positive resolution quickly, and this doesn't take, you know, a year or two to get through it, which, you know, these grizzly bear issues and roads can definitely take that long.
That will ultimately depend on if the Forest Service moves forward with its appeal, how many closed roads it finds may still be in use, and whether it can find an effective way to close them for good. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
The U.S. House passed the National Defense Authorization Act yesterday. That means the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Montana is halfway to federal recognition. But will the tribe's land base include Hill 57? Olivia Reingold reports.
On this vote, the yeas are 376, the nays are 48. The conference report is adopted.
Montana Republican Greg Gianforte voted yay on the defense bill, passing a version of the Little Shell recognition bill he's introduced in the House twice. Assuming the bill passes the Senate, which is expected to vote early next week, the Little Shell will be recognized after generations of struggle, but it could take years to figure out the details. The bill guarantees a land base within these counties: Blaine, Cascade, Glacier, and Hill. Tribal Chairman Gerald Gray says the next step will be to meet with the Department of Interior to see what acres are available.
You don't know if it will include Hill 57?
No, I don't. I don't even know what's available there.
Hill 57 is an area a few miles west of Great Falls that served as a nexus for the Little Shell community until the 1990s.
To be honest with you, I've never looked into it. I've never been that presumptuous to say, you know, we're going to be here or nothing like that.
Other things to be determined include how much federal funding the tribe will receive for education, healthcare, and economic development. A Department of Interior spokesperson says that depends on how many tribal members it has. For reference, a tribe with less than 3,000 members usually gets $320,000. The Little Shell tribe has 5,400 members. The defense bill is expected to pass before the congressional session ends next week. And assuming it does, the tribe will have a year before funding kicks in. It can request supplemental funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs before then, but the spokesperson says there are no guarantees. If DC defies expectations and the defense bill doesn't pass until January, it'll be 2 years until the tribe receives full funding. President Donald Trump says he'll sign the bill immediately, as soon as it reaches his desk. Then the Little Shell will no longer be one of the more than 400 unrecognized tribes in the U.S. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Olivia Reingold is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Corps member. Flathead County is canceling its decade-old shuttle service in Glacier National Park. County officials say the park isn't keeping up its end of the deal as growing crowds drive up costs. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
Flathead County and Glacier National Park have been in a standoff in recent months over the cost of shuttle services in the park and how to potentially expand them. Those disputes escalated Wednesday when county officials voted to stop shuttle service altogether, claiming county taxpayers are subsidizing the park. County Commissioner Randy Brodell.
I'm going to support this termination letter. It is with a heavy heart. However, I believe our door is open for the park to make a proposal back to us.
According to the county, annual ridership has increased by nearly 160% since the shuttle service started in 2007. When Glacier National Park unveiled its new management plan to deal with growing visitation numbers in September, it made clear it wanted to increase the county's shuttle services inside of the park. Over the past 2 months, the county has told the park funding would need to increase by nearly 50% next year in order to keep up with maintenance and administrative costs. The county has also been pushing a separate deal with Glacier to cooperatively expand shuttle service throughout the Flathead Valley and connect several bus routes to the park. Glacier Superintendent Jeff Mao spoke during public comment.
I just want to say, you know, the park is still supportive of an integrated transit system. We want to be part of that conversation. We know we need to be part of that conversation. And I think, you know, there is that opportunity now that I have the engagement of the Washington and the regional offices to help move that forward. So
all three county commissioners voted to cancel the shuttle contract. In a press release, Glacier said it's pursuing new options to revive service. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Federal crop insurance is a safety net for many farmers and rural communities, but it typically favors the big commodities like corn, soybeans, wheat, and cotton. A few years ago, a new type of insurance emerged to cover everything grown or raised on a farm under one umbrella, even specialty crops like hemp and lavender that don't have their own policies. It's been slow to catch on, but a few modifications may entice more farmers to get on board in 2020. Rachel Kramer reports.
Jeff Szczesenski, an economist with the Butte-based organization National Center for Appropriate Technology, says whole farm revenue protection insurance takes a very different approach to what most farmers are used to. Instead of an insurance policy focusing on a specific crop, whole farm protects the income generated by a farm.
Basically, it says to the farmer, grow the combination of crops you would like to grow that you think are most profitable for you to make a living.
Szczesenski says whole farm incentivizes people to diversify their operations. Farmers who grow more types of crops and raise livestock pay lower premiums. He says not putting all your eggs in one basket makes good economic sense while also supporting better soil health, biodiversity, and less dependence on chemical inputs. This type of insurance is also really useful for producers who want to grow specialty crops.
Production of lavender, interestingly, is really kind of a hot thing around the country, and people want to grow lavender. And there's no individual lavender policy in the United States.
With whole farm, lavender would be covered. Shezensky helped get Whole Farm authorized with the 2014 Farm Bill. It's the first crop insurance policy available in every county nationwide, which is a big deal. In Montana, for example, only 8 counties have crop insurance for potatoes, whereas all but 2 counties have it for wheat. But the adoption of this new type of insurance has been relatively slow. Around 2,200 policies were sold in the U.S. last year, with fewer than 60 in Montana, according to AgriPulse. Shezensky says part of that is it's hard for people to change.
It's just so different that people say, well, I don't know, that just seems too weird, you know, I don't want to try it.
He says getting Whole Farm also requires a little more paperwork, like turning in taxes, which can make some people feel uncomfortable. There have been some challenges with how coverage levels are determined as well. Farmers with Whole Farm can insure up to 85% of their average revenue. In the past, that average was based on the last 5 years. If one of those years had low yields due to something like drought or hail, that skewed the average and resulted in less coverage. Shezensky says deductibles will be lower in 2020 and farmers will have the option of dropping a really bad year so the average more accurately reflects typical farm revenue. He says more people may sign up now that the policy has been modified. Doug Crabtree says being able to drop a bad year made a big difference. He uses the insurance policy for his 9,600-acre farm near Havre, where a small team grows 15 to 20 different small grains, pulses, and oilseed crops.
What we're experiencing with climate change impacts, we've had insurance claims in 2 of the last 5 years. So, you know, when we did the math, if they hadn't made that change, we probably would not have the policy today.
Crabtree was on a team to help design Whole Farm at the beginning stages, and he says there are still some kinks that need to be worked out. But he says he would encourage any farmer growing specialty crops or more than 3 or 4 types to meet with an insurance agent to get a quote. Farmers have until March to sign up for their insurance policies. Jeff Shezensky with the National Center for Appropriate Technology will host a webinar Thursday morning about insuring hemp in 2020. Right now, the only option of the burgeoning crop is with the Whole Farm Revenue Protection Policy. More information is available at our website, ypradio.org. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Beltway Democrats and Republicans are both claiming victory over this week's announced overhaul of the 25-year-old NAFTA trade agreement. Back home in Montana, farmers and ranchers are still sifting through the PAC's details with a fine-tooth comb. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien has some of their early reactions.
2019 can't end quickly enough for some Montana farmers. Just ask Lola Raska.
It's been a long year.
Raska is executive vice president of the Montana Grain Growers Association.
We had good production in a lot of the state, but there were multiple pockets where they've had some severe quality issues. There's still some grain standing in the field in some areas of Montana.
Between uncooperative weather, lousy commodity prices, and a roller coaster international trade environment, Montana ag needs a shot in the arm. Raska says the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the successor to the long-vilified NAFTA trade accord, might just be that ticket.
We're very pleased with USMCA and think it needs to be passed by Congress here as soon as possible so we can have some certainty.
Republican Congressman Greg Gianforte agrees. Montana's lone representative in the U.S. House describes USMCA as a big win for both the United States and Montana ag.
Our grain growers rely on foreign markets. 80% of the grain grown in Montana does go outside of Montana and outside the country. That's why this USMCA with Canada and Mexico is so important. We do 6 times more business with Canada and Mexico than we do with China.
Gianforte says he personally hashed out a provision with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer that could eventually reap big rewards for Montana grain.
Any Montana grain going to Canada will now be graded according to Canadian domestic grain standards. Without this agreement, any grain from Montana grain growers going to Canada gets graded as feed quality. Montana grain growers are not getting a fair price for their grain in Canada. USMCA fixes that.
The grain growers' executive VP, Lola Raska, describes the provision as a, quote, very optimistic first step, end quote, but one that doesn't completely resolve the problem.
USMCA says that if wheat is grown outside of the country, if it's one of the varieties that's registered in Canada, then it will be graded on the same level as Canadian-grown wheat. there's still that criteria that it has to be a Canadian variety, and that's the next step that we have to work on.
In other words, there are currently only a handful of Montana wheat varieties registered in Canada, and those are worth a lot more to Montana farmers. Raska says expanding that list could be a lengthy and cumbersome process, but one worth the effort. The updated trade pact received a generally warm response from the U.S. meat and poultry industries, but there are dissenting voices. Steve Charter runs a cow-calf operation about 30 miles north of Billings and is a member of the Northern Plains Resource Council.
Well, the main thing we've been focusing on is mandatory country of origin labeling that we call COOL.
The COOL provision requires meat labeling detailing where the animal was born, raised, and slaughtered. Some American ranchers say its advantage is twofold: clarity to consumers while providing American cattle producers leverage to compete against the growing volume of cheaper imported beef and cattle from Canada and Mexico. Congress repealed the labeling provision almost 5 years ago. Again, Montana rancher Steve Charter.
And as far as we know, that didn't make it in. So we just think that that trade agreement without that doesn't really support American producers.
Congressman Gene Forte.
I have an agricultural advisory committee that advises me on these things. I've had specific calls with producers, all the producer organizations in the state. There isn't consensus on what should be done with COOL. If the industry agrees, I'm happy to represent them, but there isn't one school of thought there.
The House could vote on the new USMCA trade pact in the coming weeks, but the deal isn't expected to be considered by the U.S. Senate this year. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says it will likely be pushed off until after the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.